This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Hi.
And also still with us here in Edmond, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here with you.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Well, the big story this week is that some important European nations are becoming demonstrably more enthusiastic about strongman-style leadership. And this was particularly evident this week in Austria. To tell us about this, we'll go to our man there in Europe, Richard Palmer.
Yes, we see in Austria, we see the solution or the end game to Europe's political crisis. You know, I think 2 weeks ago, I was on this show talking about Spain, where mainstream political parties have crumpled in the polls and nobody can form an effective government. And we've seen this trend play out all across Europe, and it's just led to political dysfunction and paralysis. Well, Austria is one of the big exceptions to that trend, where it's not that they haven't even affected that trend. It's been turned around completely. So Austria's mainstream white right-wing party, the Austrian People's Party, they look like they were going to be one of these once main, now extinct political parties. Back in 2017, they were polling below 20%. In fact, they were polling significantly behind Austria's far right party that kind of has links to the Nazi era and the Waffen-SS and all of this historical baggage. And they were doing significantly worse. Then along came the man who went on to become Austria's chancellor, Sebastian Kurz. And he brought a whole new approach to Austrian politics. He completely revived that party's way of doing things and their constitution, the party's constitution, not the country's, that is, but to concentrate power with himself. The Austrian People's Party basically became Kurz's party. And he was almost this presidential-like figure. He brought this message of really clamping down on migrants. But he was very careful at the same time not to sound like a Nazi, somebody who you could still be proud to support and kind of praise in public, but would deal with the migrant crisis. He was very close to the Catholic Church, especially the Archbishop of Vienna, Cardinal Schönborn, and he talked a lot about religious heritage, Europe's religious heritage. But anyway, people loved his message. Back in 2017, he completely turned around his party's fortune, and they won the election then with 30% of the vote, and that was considered a big change for this declining party. He came in, and he went into coalition with Austria's far-right party, with this party with the Nazi roots, which was a pretty big development for all of Europe, to have a mainstream party bring in a far-right party, a mainstream politician, bring a far-right party into their government the way that he did. They governed like that for a couple of years. There was a scandal mostly reflecting badly on his far-right counterparts, coalition partners. Government fell apart. He tried to lead a minority government. The opposition torpedoed that. Fresh elections. And then over the weekend, Kurz came back with a renewed majority or a renewed popularity, 37% of the vote, which in Austria's political system that has four or five kind of bigger parties and it's always a coalition, 37% of the vote is a landslide. So he has really proven he has the secret to success in Europe, the secret to success that other politicians have been searching for the last decade. He's been able to take votes from the far right and to solidify himself in power.
So Kurz is back and he's stronger than he was before. I remember back in 2011 when Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, who was Germany's defense minister at the time, when he was forced to resign because of a scandal, at that time, Mr. Ron Fraser, the late trumpet columnist, said that in European politics, sometimes a period of exile can actually be a great boost to a politician's long-term power. He explained that it can sometimes act in a way that sort of matures that politician in the eyes of the populace and ends up being almost like a rite of passage to a more serious second act in that politician's political career. Do you think that there's validity to that, and that anything like that may have been at play with Kurtz here and could possibly factor into a return with zu Gutenberg himself?
I mean, I think it's an interesting point. I don't think there's anything. I think Kurtz was only out of power for a couple of months, so I don't think it's not like, I guess he'd be on this big soul-searching journey during that time. But you know, I think it's more that because he was out of power, he was able to make it look like, okay, they're all ganging up on me, they're attacking me, and he drew some votes, I think, from that. And then I think in terms of German politics, what's been interesting, what's doing for me over the last week or so, you know, is just looking at Germany's reaction to Kurtz. Joshua Michels is a German speaker, a native German. He's been doing some translating of some of these news articles. He's put together a summary, actually, of some of what these papers have been saying that we'll have up on our website next week. But you've had big publications publishing articles like Five Lessons That Germany Can Learn from Austria, or Is Kurtz an Example for the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union? And you've got this big impression in Germany of, well, we need a Kurtz. You know, we're having the same problems that Austria used to be having, mm-hmm. where all of our mainstream parties had declined in popularity. Nobody was able to kind of form any strong government. You're left with these weak, unstable coalitions. We had that problem. Kurtz has figured out how to fix it. We need a Kurtz. And what I think is really interesting is some papers have agreed with that, but then they've also made the point that, well, yeah, Kurtz kind of shows us the way to do that. And we can look at having the strong man type individual and this being strong on migrants and this relationship with the Catholic Church that allows Kurtz to kind of take rhetoric from the far right without looking like a Nazi himself. I think that partnership with the Catholic Church is crucial to give him that very, that man of the people, but still kind of like a good man image. But they've been looking at that and saying, but that's not enough. You also need a Kurtz. You also need somebody who's charismatic, somebody who can be the figurehead for all that. And they're saying, well, if Angela Merkel were to steal all of Kurtz's policies tomorrow, that wouldn't be enough. And so they were asking, well, where's our Kurtz? Where's our charismatic individual that can put all of this into practice? And Angela Merkel's, they're pointing out, well, Angela Merkel's successor isn't very popular. She's not somebody who can play that Kurtz role. Where is there a Kurtz? And you mentioned zu Gutenberg. I mean, he is exactly in the mold of Sebastian Kurtz. I mean, even the two of them here, Mr. zu Gutenberg will go and speak at events with Mr. Kurtz. The two of them know each other, support each other. He comes across in the same way, young, pretty good looking, charismatic, somebody who could be that strongman, you know, that figurehead, that icon. So he really is the perfect candidate for Austria's Kurtz. And the other thing, or Germany's Kurtz, the other thing I think is really interesting is, if you haven't done so already, I'd really urge you to watch all of our listeners to watch our Key of David program this week from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, because it's on exactly this subject. It's on a coming German strongman. Now, this is a prophecy that we've been watching for years. The Bible is very clear that, and there's prophecies like Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 that talk about a strong man coming in Europe. And Mr. Flurry goes through all of those in his program and explains those, proves that they're talking about a strong man. But what he does in that program is he really dives pretty deeply into those scriptures and what exactly they say about this strong man. And you can build up quite a detailed picture. You know, he's somebody who's of a high social status. He is somebody who is very intelligent, very well educated. He has a background in a whole load of these different areas. Somebody who's very charismatic. The Bible talks about him getting where he needs to be by flatteries. You know, he's able to really get on well with people, create a good impression and get on well, even with very intelligent, very sophisticated politicians. He is just a magnificent politician. He's the Bible talks about him being skilled in dark sentences. And Mr. Fleury talks in that Key of David a fair bit about exactly what that means. But the picture that you get, I mean, Mr. Fleury doesn't talk about him in that show, but the picture that you get is someone that's very similar to Kurtz. And it is, he makes a point in that show. You look in Germany, where is there someone that matches that description? Well, there's nobody that matches it quite as well as zu Gutenberg, which is why we've been pointing to him for so long. But you see this zu Gutenberg-like leadership already succeeding in other places in Europe. You already see these other strongmen politics doing well in Europe. And we've been talking about Italy as well on this show, where you see similar policies, where this kind of cult of personality plus this religious sounding language and hard line on migrants, this push to, okay, here's somebody who will lead us to be proud in our country. You see that doing really well all across Europe. And you know, we've been saying for years it's coming to Germany, and the Germans themselves are now saying, well, where's the man that can do this for Germany?
We'll be sure to include a link in the show notes to that Key of David episode so that listeners can just better understand these important developments in their prophetic context. Thanks very much for that, Richard. So it's clear that the Europeans are becoming more enthusiastic about strongman leaders. And meanwhile, this week in China, we saw one of the world's strongest strongmen showcase his might for the whole world to see. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony.
The People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, and this past Tuesday marked the 70th anniversary of that founding. And the Chinese celebrated the anniversary by rolling thousands of tons of military hardware through the streets of Beijing, and Chairman Xi Jinping was right there to preside over the whole event, and it was a massive parade. And it wasn't just a demonstration of China's national pride and its military power, but it was also a demonstration of the way that military is entirely loyal to Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese military is officially known as the People's Liberation Army, but in reality, it is essentially the army of China's Communist Party, and that makes it quite different from many other countries, especially in the West, where you can have controversies about the potential politicization of the military. In China, it's actually the other way around, where they're actually on guard for the depoliticization of the military. So any PLA leaders or even soldiers that might not be very thrilled about the Communist Party, they can be swiftly removed from office. And that's because the army's main purpose is to defend the party, not just from foreign threats, but even from domestic ones as well. And Xi Jinping, the commander-in-chief of this army, he has recently become the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. And he has done that by having his name and ideology written into the constitution, and by removing term limits that may potentially have him rule for life. And this parade really had him front and center. And during that parade, he was driven down to complete an inspection of all the vehicles and soldiers that were assembled there. And the big part of the message of this parade was to show that this massive army was loyal to Xi Jinping and to the Communist Party.
Yeah, it was a really eye-popping demonstration. I watched several videos of the parade, and it really was astounding. And there was also quite a lot of brand new military hardware that was on display. Could you talk a little bit about just exactly what was unveiled?
Yeah, China used this parade to unveil some really powerful and homemade weapons, which is a departure from the past, where you know it was buying all these foreign weapons, but now it was showcasing some of the ones they made themselves. It introduced several types of advanced unmanned systems. One was the WZ-8 supersonic reconnaissance unmanned aircraft. There was also the GJ-11 stealth aircraft. And there was also an unmanned submarine called the HSU-001, which is an expansive range, and that one particularly shows that China is interested in going way beyond its coasts, way beyond the South China Sea, and it's really developing long-range blue water naval capabilities. There were a few other weapons. It introduced the world to the DF-17 hypersonic glide vehicle, which can carry ballistic missiles. The DF-41, which is an intercontinental range ballistic missiles. That's what it can carry. Solid fuel, and it can be transported by road. It can deliver a nuclear payload anywhere in the U.S., even to multiple cities at once. And it's really becoming the cornerstone of China's strategic deterrence. So China really showed this week that it has all sorts of new weapons and it is ready to fight future wars.
Could you place this in context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, like we mentioned, it's a lot of it has to do with the South China Sea, and these weapons are really showing that China is really determined to maintain a tight grip of the South China Sea and to intimidate its neighbors into obeying it. And these are developments that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said are steering the world toward war. He wrote an article in July 2016 where he said this, quote, "Since World War II, America has protected the South China Sea and brought peace to this part of the world. Now the American military is retreating and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And Mr. Fleury wrote this analysis based on Bible prophecy. One of those prophecies is found in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, where God warns the nations of Israel, which are primarily the United States and the UK. And God warns in that prophecy that if these nations reject his authority, he will give control over the world's strategic sea lanes and sea gates to their enemies. And he said that Mr. Fleury said in the article that China's rapidly expanding military capability shows how quickly this prophecy could be fulfilled in the South China Sea. So for listeners who want to learn more about this and about the prophetic significance of this, they can read that article from Mr. Gerald Fleury, and it's titled "China is Steering the World Toward War."
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. So we have strongmen rising in Europe and in Asia and just casting long shadows over America and its allies. And then this week we saw evidence of a related trend underway in the Middle East, where Iran is growing more aggressive in its threats and in its push against the status quo. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, it's almost like Iran's had strongman leadership for 40-plus years now, and it's... Actually, events this week showed just how strong it was. There was an important interview that took place between Iranian media and Qasem Soleimani. He's the head of the Quds Force, their expeditionary arm that basically leads all of Iran's actions outside the country. And he sat down and he described the relationship he has with Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah, and he said directly how he reports directly to him, and then he goes about and he acts in Lebanon and elsewhere following out those commands, which shows how there is leadership behind Iran's movements, and that comes from this one strong man, the Ayatollah. And some of his generals also came out and said today, this week, that they were increasing the fight against Israel. The other leader for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Major General Salami, he's the head of that now. He came out and said this week that the guards, he said this quote, "The sinister regime talking about Israel must be wiped off the map, and this is no longer a dream, but it's an achievable goal." And then he said, "For decades from Iran's Islamic Revolution, we have managed to obtain the capacity to destroy the imposter Zionist regime." And so we hear those things, we've heard them a lot from Iran, But this is a little bit different. It comes from one of the chief generals that he answers. This man answers directly to the Ayatollah as well. And he says that they now have the capacity to destroy Israel. You could say it's just bluster, but the very same day that he said this, there was a border crossing that opened between Iraq and Syria. This is one of the main roadways or highways that will allow Iran to access the border of Israel across the states of Iraq and Syria. That opened for the first time in 8 years, and it's staffed on the Iraqi side by Shiite militias that answer to Iran. And so he came out and said, we can now do it. We now have control of the Iraqi state to a degree that is going to allow us to have allow us to cross this boundary into Syria with our armaments. That's going to allow it to bring more forces into Syria that can push up against Israel. And so they are, it seems, pushing towards that goal. And this, again, is coming from the top of the Iranian nation.
So on the show a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that the Israelis had actually struck this very border crossing from the Israeli side.
That's right. They struck it from the Israeli side and hit the Syrian side of the border crossing.
And but yet the Iranians were undeterred.
Yeah, I think Israel was caught by surprise by how fast that Iran managed to rebuild and rebuild this base. This is on the Syrian side. They have weapons there. The Iranians do already. And even though it was flattened and there was a couple of dozen Iranian soldiers and militia that were killed in that attack, we could see the satellite imagery that it was. They just went back there and they rebuilt it. Undeterred by Israel's massive strikes. And that's on the Syrian side, and they're meant to have less control of the Iranians, that is, on what happens on the Syrian side. The Iraqi side is further in Iran's camp. And so, what this shows is, regardless of Israel's strikes, Iran is going to continue with its push into Syria. They have what they believe now is an achievable goal. I mean, Israel right now came out this week and they talked about how their missile defense system is not going to be enough to counter such an attack that we saw taking place on Saudi Arabia on September 14, when you had these low-flying drones and these cruise missiles. These are missiles that are agile, can move. They're harder to detect than ballistic missiles even. And Israel is saying that we need to reanalyze our defensive capabilities to be able to counter that type of style attack that Iran could right now direct against Israel. They chose Saudi Arabia, but they could have easily decided to have such an attack against Israel. And so, again, Israel is strong in terms of its military power, but Iran remains undeterred, even though there's been thousands of strikes against their interests in Syria and now in Iraq. They're still pushing forward towards their goal. Now, Bible prophecy indicates that in terms of Syria, Iran is eventually going to lose control of that nation. They're going to fall out of the Iranian sphere of influence, based on Psalm chapter 83, that shows that Syria is going to align with the Europeans rather than Iran. But what I want to focus on in this report is, by mentioning this border crossing, is that Iran will find a way to continue its attack against Israel, even if they are cut off temporarily from the Syrian avenue in the future. They are very dedicated towards this cause. It comes from the top, even if their soldiers are treated like cannon fodder, the Iranian soldiers, that is. They are willing to push forward towards this. This isn't going to go away until, as the Bible says, superior force is going to put down Iran's ambition.
What would you recommend for listeners who would like to learn more about this?
Yeah, we have an article by Warren Reinsch on The Trumpet posted this week. It's entitled "Iraq-Syria Border Crossing Reopens Under Iranian Control." If we put that in the show notes, you can read through that and get more of the biblical analysis in terms of prophecy at the end of that article.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll take a look at the political turmoil that's happening right now in the U.S. and what this means for the future of the nation. To tell us about this, we'll turn it over to Andrew.
Yeah, attempts to remove United States President Donald Trump from office are tearing at the social fabric of the nation, with some key figures even throwing around the term civil war. And just to recap for our listeners what this impeachment crisis is all about, on September 24th, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, announced that she was initiating an informal impeachment inquiry against President Trump. The charge is that he tried to strong-arm a foreign leader, the president of Ukraine, into investigating a political rival, specifically the son of a Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden. Now, President Trump has released the transcript of that call, and looking through that, shown that these the charges are definitely exaggerated. He didn't strong-arm or threaten anyone. In particular, he was asking the president of Ukraine to help him investigate Joe Biden and other people in the Democratic Party who were involved in the Obama administration's attempts to use the Steele dossier and intelligence from British intelligence agents to spy on him during the 2016 presidential campaign. And so those more details will be forthcoming. We actually have an article on our website by Daniel DeSanto entitled The Manufactured Ukraine Crisis that gives a little bit more details as to the debate back and forth over what's going on with this impeachment probe. But in the segment today, I want to talk a little bit more about the political fallout from this, because this is actually something that this impeachment could happen. There's 220 people in the House of Representatives who support the inquiry. It only takes 218 to impeach. So if like 93-94% of Democrats stand united, they could push this impeachment inquiry through, or not the inquiry, but an actual impeachment vote through, if right. It comes to that. Now, an impeachment's just a formal declaration of wrongdoing. No one has to leave office unless you lose a Senate trial after that. And since the Republicans control the Senate with 53 seats out of 100, that's very, very unlikely that that's going to happen.
Does it look like any of those Republican senators, though, would vote against the president?
Not unless some major piece of information that we don't have comes to light. At this point, it looks like that the possibility is that you could do similar to like what happened in the late 90s with Bill Clinton, where you're impeached but not convicted.
Right.
Although this would be a first in American history in that President Trump's not backing down, and since this is in his first term, he's obviously still going to run for re-election. He might still win re-election, which would definitely be the first time in American history.
Impeached and then re-elected.
An impeached president runs for office and is potentially re-elected.
Right.
Just shows how divisive that next election campaign will get. And that's where the term civil war is being thrown around. Obviously, President Trump has a huge following amongst the evangelical Christian community in the United States. About 80% of evangelical voters supported President Trump, and about 26% of voters are evangelical. So I guess whatever 80% of 26% is you're getting to the size of this this block. And so the Fox News actually talked with Pastor Robert Jeffries. He's a pastor of about a congregation of about 13,000 people in Dallas. Is on the news a lot. He's a fairly prominent evangelical leader in the United States, to see how he thinks the evangelical community is responding to this. And he's been traveling around the nation. He's talking to several different churches, and he's really put a spotlight on how angry the evangelical Christians are at this attempt by the Democrats to remove a duly elected president from office. And it was him who was talking about this Civil War-like division. We actually have that clip from Fox and Friends that we can play now.
Look, I don't pretend to speak for all evangelicals, but this week I have been traveling the country and I've literally spoken to thousands and thousands of evangelical Christians. I have never seen them more angry over any issue than this attempt to illegitimately remove this president from office, overturn the 2016 election, and negate the votes of millions of evangelicals in the process. And they know that the only impeachable offense President Trump has committed was beating Hillary Clinton in 2016. That's the unpardonable sin for which the Democrats will never forgive him. And I do want to make this prediction this morning. If the Democrats are successful in removing the president from office, I'm afraid it will cause a civil war-like fracture in this nation from which this country will never heal.
Right. So this this prominent evangelical leader is talking about a civil war-like fracture in this nation from which the country will never fully heal, with large segments of voters believing with good evidence that this is an attempt by the Democratic Party and whistleblowers within the CIA, deep state officials to remove a president from office simply for trying to investigate what the Obama administration did to his political campaign in 2016, illegally did his political campaign in 2016.
And President Trump actually tweeted some of those quotes from Robert Jeffress about a possible civil war as well, which I think just shows how seriously some of those remarks are being taken.
Right, that he did. He retweeted the pretty much the whole clip we just played. So that shows kind of his tactic endorsement of this is what the Democrats are trying to do to come against him for winning the election,
right.
And not for any particular crime he did. I mean, those details are still forthcoming, but it looks at worst case scenario, it's like a minor misdemeanor for asking a president to Ukraine. Maybe he should have had the attorney general do it instead of doing it himself. I'm not an expert on those ins and out of those legal laws. But it's definitely nothing compared to the crime he's trying to get the bottom of with the Obama campaign using an unverified piece of propaganda to undermine a sitting president.
So it looks like the U.S. Is just increasingly divided. No matter what direction this goes in, you would just see both sides polarized and sort of galvanized by it. Could you place that in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, absolutely. After President Trump was elected, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote an article entitled America's Coming Civil War, which we'll put in the show notes. And he wrote in that article that many Americans are troubled by divisions and hatred being expressed right now, but they need to be a lot more concerned than they are. These problems are going to get worse and worse until people get the message and they learn why these disasters are happening. Donald Trump's win is a prophetic sign of impending civil war and anarchy followed by America's worst ever military defeat. And then he goes on in that to say, but you don't, something that you don't want to put too much blame on the politicians and the race baiters and other figures like that on, because this is, at the end of the day, divine punishment for the sins of the nation. If you go through Isaiah 1, it talks about how an ox knows its master, but Israel doesn't know its God, and it's rebelled against God. And then that's a verse we quote quite a bit on this program, saying that, ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children are their corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord and provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger. They have gone away backward. Why should you be stricken anymore? Why will you revolt more and more? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. And this is talking about that the head of something is the, it's like government. If you're like the head of a nation is the government of a nation. Talking about the government in America is sick through and out the CIA, through and out the deep state, through and out Congress, just fighting each other. In some cases, even more than they're concerned about foreign enemies. And this is just escalating more and more until this is going to break out into anarchy and rioting, like Mr. Fleury points to in that articles, because of the sins of the nation.
We'll be sure to leave a link to that article in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these very important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about a landmark ruling by the European Court of Justice, protests in Iraq, a provocative North Korean weapons test, and how a science catastrophe in South America could devastate its populations. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The European Court of Justice made a chilling ruling that extends far beyond the borders of Europe this week. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yes, chilling is the right word. It's a massive power grab for Europe. And you know, we've been following this story for a year or so now, where Europe has been trying to enforce their control on the internet. It's something Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerard Flurry has written on. It was one of his cover articles a few months ago. And this might be one of the biggest steps yet that Europe has taken to censor speech on the internet. The European Court of Justice ruled just yesterday, and their ruling said two things. The first says that if a country's court rules that some content is illegal, Facebook must take down any other content that is posted after that ruling that is deemed equivalent or identical. So it means in practice that Facebook has to set up a massive automatic filter of all of their texts so that if a court rules that something is illegal, no one else can post that text. So just like some earlier law, it forces Facebook to build a censorship machine. And then the second part of that ruling is even more significant. And that says that if an EU nation rules that a piece of content is illegal and must be taken down in that nation, Facebook has to take it down everywhere in the world. So it's setting up EU's individual nations' laws to mandate what people can read all around the world. And this, I think, is going to signal a starting gun on potentially even a push for global censorship. I mean, first of all, just look at Europe. Europe does not have a First Amendment. European nations don't. And they do not have the same long-standing traditions of free speech that we enjoy in Britain and America. You know, they, in several EU countries, Les Majestés laws are still on the books that forbid criticism of the church or of politicians. Now, these days, they're not often enforced, but that's just to show there's no free speech tradition. I was on this show, maybe it was like a year ago, and we were talking about how Austria ruled that calling the Prophet Muhammad a pedophile was illegal, even though by any empirical standard he was. I mean, he married a six-year-old. What else do you call that? Anyway, they ruled that that was illegal. So potentially now, if someone were to post that on Facebook, and Austria were to rule again that that was illegal and must be taken down, anyone anywhere in the world would not be able to say on Facebook Muhammad is a pedophile. Even somebody in the United States would, which is where I think you end up starting the starting gun on some kind of a conflict, because then if somebody in the United States could then take Facebook to court and say, no, I have a First Amendment right to say this, and the government, the U.S. government may well, or the judiciary may well rule in their favor, and you start having a bit of a tussle here. I think it's only a matter of time before China gets involved and says something like, well, okay, we're going to say that criticizing China on Facebook anywhere in the world is illegal, and you're going to end up having some of these U.S. tech companies kind of caught in the middle. But it's a major step for censorship. It causes major problems for these U.S. tech companies and could really diminish their global reach. They may just end up pulling out of certain countries if it's just not worth getting repeatedly fined for some of these things. But a major step towards censorship.
Yeah, you mentioned China there, and they get a lot of flack in the Western world for what is often called the Great Firewall of China. they, you know, don't allow their citizens to read anything on the internet or even access sites that are not approved by the government and that have a, you know, a strong pro-China message to them. But in many ways, though, this European, these maneuvers by the European leaders are more alarming than that, just because they do extend beyond just their own borders. It's not just China controlling what Chinese people read. It's Europeans having a say in what anyone around the entire world could read. So that seems really alarming to me.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a good point about China. I mean, right now, some of these companies like Facebook don't really have a big presence there. But I think it's only a matter of time before they try this with some company. But yeah, I mean, you can sit there in the United States and kind of almost be aghast when you see some of these different news stories, not just coming out of China, but coming out of, say, Canada or Europe, where they're passing these human rights laws that are really restrictive on what people can say. You know, I think there was the big court case 10, 15 years ago or so with Mark Stein in Canada, and you know, some of just common sense things that were being ruled as hate speech. I think from that, somebody ruled like the song Kung Fu Fighters was racist and hate speech. And so, you know, you're getting ridiculous rulings. But the point is that, yeah, in America, it's been nice. You can sit there and be exempt from all of that and be protected by your First Amendment and know, well, these hate speech laws in other countries that say you can't criticize Muslims or you can't criticize transgenders or certain protective groups, they're less likely to affect me. Well, yeah, now you can see where a whole lot of this can start to affect you, where these other countries are trying to import their restrictive speech laws and foist them not just on their own people, like you said, but the entire world.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, so in the July 2019 Trump in Print edition, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has an article, Germany is taking control of the internet. And really, you know, this is from the European Court of Justice, but he makes the point, you know, Germany is right there at the back of the European Union. They're the ones in the driving seat on just about everything. I mean, the European Court of Justice just rules on whatever Europe wants it to rule. And so it very rarely rules against anything meaningful to European integration and to Germany's interests. And in that article, he goes through some of the other attempts that Europe have had, very similar to this one, to use things like copyright directive to control what people say around the world. And he talks about how the internet is really a fantastic tool it's got some massive evils, but it's a fantastic tool for getting a message out. But it gives America's control of some of those big tech companies, gives them a lot of power. And he says, well, you look at the way Europe wants to dominate these tech companies, the way that Europe wants to dominate what is said on the internet, and it exposes the rise of a power that really wants to dominate, this European power that wants to be able to control what people say, what people think, that when America has some kind of power, they're jealous of that, and they look at a way of trying to take that over. And so what you see in Europe, you know, you see that getting ready. We talked about the strong man that would rise in the first half. So the Bible prophesies you're going to have a kind of dictatorial power in Europe led by a strong man. And with some of these rulings about controlling the internet, you're seeing the infrastructure for that type of power being built, where Europe can be a power that's almost like China in that it controls what people can and can't say. You know, the Bible says that's the direction Europe is going in, and with some of these copyright directives and things like that, you see Europe moving in that direction.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll go to Iraq, where anti-government protests have resulted in numerous deaths and injuries. To tell us about this, we'll turn it back over to Brent.
Yeah, this isn't just another protest in another Middle Eastern country. This is quite significant. Iraq right now is facing this tussle between America, basically, and Iran, and trying to place a middle road and not yielding its influence fully to either side. And these protests, although it isn't being reported as such about that, this is where why these people are really coming out in the streets en masse. Right now, there's been about 50 plus people that have been killed as we record this on Friday. That's probably going to go up. And so two questions we have to ask: what caused these protests? And then, you know, what is causing also the strong response from the government? And these protests started earlier this week. And it seems like they are a response to a couple of actions by the Iraqi government, forces inside the Iraqi government that want to draw Iraq closer to Iran rather than holding on to some type of impartial, let's say, sphere of influence, or accepting the sphere of influence of the US or Iran. And there was the dismissal late last week of a powerful Iraqi general, the deputy commander of Iraq's counterterrorism bureau, Abdul Wahab al-Sadi. And he is basically a symbol of Iraqi nationalism. He was there for the fight against Islamic State. The Iraqi military largely faltered in the fight against Islamic State, apart from this, well, largely the forces led by this man. And so Iraqis looked at him as being not an Iranian Shiite supporter, not necessarily part of the U.S. alliance, but somebody that we can hold up to show that we are a separate nation and we are in charge of our own destiny. Well, he was removed from power this week. You also had the Iran ambassador to Iraq come out and say this week that if the United States does anything bad against Iran, we are going to fight against the United States in Iraq. We're going to use Iraq as the battlefield between Iran and the U.S. That's what an Iranian ambassador said. And it's at this time that people started taking to the streets. Yes, they're fighting corruption in the government. Yes, they're upset about low standard of living and economic poverty and more unemployment. But why do they come out at precisely this time? These have been things that have been bubbling away for a year or so. And so it seems like these are a response against Iranian infiltration inside the government. And then we can look at why there have been so many deaths. Why have normally protests in a democracy, which Iraq is, there are allowances for peaceful protests, which these were. And yet we've had a lot of deaths, over 50 at this point. And it seems like the deaths are being caused by, at least from what's coming in now, it's very hard. There's an internet blackout in Iraq right now. There's a curfew imposed on everybody apart from government officials. And no cars allowed on the streets apart from government and emergency vehicles. And so it's hard to get reports, the accurate reports out. But it looks like the forceful response with live fire ammunition on the protesters is being caused by the Shiite militias that belong to Iran. They are putting down this rebellion forcefully, the Iranian elements inside Iraq.
So would there be an opportunity here for the United States possibly to try to, you know, boost the momentum of these protests to kind of guide Iraq onto another path, maybe into a direction that makes it less aligned with Iran?
Well, I think that is an option for the United States right now. We can go back, and even our article in on the Trumpet, anti-government protest spark in Iran, talks about this. And we can go back to what happened in Iran itself. In 2009, there was the Green Movement, which was a spontaneous uprising against Ahmadinejad and his policies of exporting the revolution outside of Iran. They were also facing economic turmoil. The people were upset. Unemployment was high, and the similar type of situation. And this was an uprising that wanted to get rid of the clerical regime in Iran. And we've talked about that this was the chance for President Obama to, instead of supporting, let's say, anti-Western powers, as he did in Egypt and the removal of Sisi and such, this was a chance to support a pro-democracy movement inside Iran that could have rid us of the regime that wants to take over the world. And yet there was no U.S. support that was given to that. As of this moment right now, President Trump has not come fully supportive of the protesters. Yes, he believes, his administration has said, we believe in the right to peaceful protest. But is there more that could be done to try and support the people of Iraq that aren't happy that their nation is becoming beholden to Iran? I think this is important to discuss, because we talk about Iraq falling to Iran in terms of Bible prophecy, but we forget often that there are huge swaths of the population that hate that and that are willing right now to take to the streets, threatened by live fire, to stand up to it, and are willing to die to preserve Iraqi nationalism, the independence of the Iraqi state. Bible prophecy indicates that isn't going to happen. that Iran is going to maintain its control and even increase its control over Iraq. And I think the use of these Iranian-backed Shiite militias operating in Iraq to put down the rebellion shows that they're not going to give up the gains that they've made over the past couple of years to ensure their success and their control over Iraq. Will the U.S. help? It doesn't look like. Bible prophecy indicates it's not. If it does, it's not going to be effective. And President Trump, again, doesn't want to get more involved in the Middle East. He wants less involvement there. So that probably points to him missing his green movement moment in a similar way that President Obama did miss his in terms of what happened in Iran.
Where would you send listeners who would like to understand more of that prophetic context?
They can read this article, Anti-Government Protests Spark in Iraq. Warren Reich, one of our writers that's operating out of the UK right now, has been busy this week, and he's written a couple of these articles that are very helpful in showing the prophetic elements to these stories.
Okay, we'll be sure to include a link to that. Thank you very much, Brent. For our next story, we return to Asia, where North Korea has conducted a new weapons test that is playing into a strategy to really reshape Asia's security dynamic. For this, we'll go back to Anthony.
North Korea test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile into Japanese waters on Wednesday, and that just happened one day after it announced it would resume talks with the United States about denuclearization. It's interesting, Brent's comments that he made about the United States, and I felt like there's a similarity with this situation right here. But we'll get to that in a little bit. First, let me just describe the missile. It was solid fuel-based missile. It was launched from a platform at sea, and it was the longest-range missile, solid fuel missile that North Korea ever tested. And it marks the first strategic launch since November 2017 by North Korea. And Japanese officials said that these were nuclear-capable missiles that are actually capable of striking targets 1,200 miles away. And with that kind of a range that places South Korea and Japan within the weapons range. And the North Korea's state-run KCNA wrote that the successful test firing, quote, ushered in a new phase in containing the outside forces' threat to North Korea and further bolstering its military muscle for self-defense, end quote. And one nuclear expert said that the launch really pushed the envelope, and yet the United States really hasn't done much about it. And a big part of it is because President Trump, the United States president, has been trying to cut a deal with North Korea. He has been downplaying North Korea's tests of short-range missiles that it started in May. He dismissed those tests as very standard and has stressed that unlike, ICBMs that North Korea has tested early on in his presidency, these short-range missiles cannot reach mainland USA or many overseas American assets. And like I said, he wants to strike a deal with North Korea, and that desire to do that is getting stronger and stronger, especially with what's happening in the United States, the political turmoil. And of course, he's seeking another term in office. So there will be talks again tomorrow. So it's all in the context of that. But this is causing a big problem for Japan and South Korea, which are treaty allies of the United States. Both of them rely on America for national security and defending their own interests. And they are within range of North Korea's missiles, and they are really getting worried about it. Japanese officials said that the latest test was an extremely problematic and dangerous act. And they also said that it was a serious threat to Japanese national security. And some analysts noted the same thing, saying that, you know, since North Korea has been testing these missiles, Japan has been a kind of a punching bag. So this dynamic really could drive a wedge between the United States and its Asian allies. And that might be exactly what North Korea and its main allies, China and Russia, are working to accomplish with these tests. The United States still has a strong presence in that region. It has about 28,000 military personnel in North Korea and 54,000 in Japan. And North Korea's tests could be calculated by China and Russia to undermine America's alliances with Japan and South Korea. And it's one way that these nations want to use to get the United States out of that region. And Japan and South Korea, some people in Japan and South Korea have been considering that and then boosting their own defenses so that they don't have to rely as much on the United States. Now, when the antagonism between North Korea and essentially the whole world came to its peak in 2017, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said that the world should be more concerned about Russia and China than about North Korea. And he based his analysis on the Bible, and he wrote about it in a letter to KPCG listeners and trumpet writers. He said, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia." He said, these powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea. And again, he based his prophecies on the Bible, specifically prophecies in Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation that show these nations in Asia, Russia, and China uniting to form this powerful military that will play a significant role in an upcoming World War III.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. For our final story today, we'll go to Latin America, where scientists set out to solve a problem but ended up making it much, much worse. For this, we'll turn it back over to Andrew.
Yeah, the release of genetically modified mosquitoes into the Brazilian jungle could have catastrophic consequences. The Zika virus has been a huge problem in Latin America, which is a virus borne by mosquitoes. So the British company Oxitec attempted to genetically engineered sterile mosquitoes to be released into the jungle. They'd breed with the mosquitoes carrying the virus. Because they're sterile, they wouldn't have offspring, and you'd at least reduce the population. Sounds like a good plan on paper. What ended up happening is the two mosquito populations did breed, but instead of having sterile offspring, they had pesticide-resistant offspring.
Wow.
And so now even the pesticides they previously reused to get rid of mosquitoes carrying this virus are proving less and less effective. It was revealed in a new study published by the journal Nature. Oxitec's transgenic mosquitoes are not only able to reproduce, but their presence within native mosquito populations is actually causing super mosquitoes to spawn. Now, the Zika virus is a virus that causes fever, rash, and joint pain in adults, but it's also been linked to serious birth defects, eye problems, hearing loss, slowed growth, shrunken skulls. So this is a huge problem for South America, and something that's prophetically significant. We have an article that we can put in the show notes by Wayne Turgeon titled "The Zika Virus and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse," that covers some of the prophecies contained in Revelation 6 and Matthew 24 about these four iconic horsemen that so many of the listeners have probably seen: the white horse of religious deception, the red horse of war, and then a black horse for famine, and then this pale horse representing diseases that will get worse and worse and worse continuously until it culminates in Jesus Christ's return the Zika virus being one of many of these diseases that looks like it could potentially get much and much worse due to mankind's attempts to play God and alter the genetic makeup of the mosquitoes.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. We are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember to visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories we're discussing today, and also to subscribe to our print edition and our email news brief. Please send in any questions or comments to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Jabadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And we'll leave you with the words of Theodore Rubin. There are two ways to slide easily through life, to believe everything or to doubt everything. Both ways save us from thinking. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.